The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Harvard Health Publications. And the first article I'm going to read is continuing with the March 2023 issue of the Harvard Women's Health Watch, which is a journal I've recently added to our periodicals. And the first article is entitled, Short on Slumber. Sleep deprivation is more common than ever, but it can lead to far-reaching health problems. If you use an alarm clock to wake up, it's a good bet you're sleep-deprived. But what if you feel fine when that buzzer, bell, or blast of music rouses you? You're probably still not getting all the sleep you need, the fundamental definition of sleep deprivation, or you wouldn't have required the jolt. You would have woken up by yourself. You can keep eating when you're not hungry, but you can't keep sleeping if you're not tired, says Dr. Elizabeth Klerman, a professor of neurology in Massachusetts General Hospital and the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Most adults need 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night, according to the National Sleep Foundation. But more than 35% of American adults report consistently sleeping less than 7 hours. Moreover, half of Americans say they feel sleepy during the day, between 3 and 7 days a week, meaning they're likely not getting enough nighttime rest. Women have particular problems with getting sufficient sleep, regardless of how much time we spend in bed. Our lifetime risk of insomnia is up to 40% higher than that of men. And things are only getting worse. When we examine the data, they tell us how much people have been sleeping over the last century, and it's clear we're sleeping less and less, says Dr. Ina John Logic, a neurologist at the Sleep Disorders Center at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Being short on slumber can make us dopey, sluggish, cranky, and forgetful. But consistently getting less sleep than we need can lead to serious health problems. They go far beyond a day's bad mood. Sleep deprivation affects basically everything, Dr. Klerman says. Why aren't many of us sleeping enough? Some reasons are habit-based and therefore controllable. Often, Harvard experts say, we simply don't set aside enough time for sleep and allow work or other commitments to intrude. For some parents, bedtime is their me time, when they start to watch movies and do things they enjoy at the expense of sleep, Dr. John Logic says. And it's not just bedtime procrastination. Some people get up really early to go to the gym to have time for themselves. Some also carry a misguided sense of pride in not needing sleep, boasting about how little they get, as if it's a virtue. It's almost like a competition, and there's certainly the idea that if you sleep a lot, you're a bit lazy and less productive, Dr. John Logic says. But some contributors to a lack of shut-eye are indeed out of our control. They include pregnancy, menopause-related night sweats, certain medications, sleep disorders like insomnia, sleep apnea, and restless leg syndrome, ailments like chronic pain, cancer, depression, or dementia. Whatever the cause, skipping shut-eye can be disastrous. The immediate effect of sleep deprivation is a lack of alertness that can translate into more accidents in cars and other situations, Dr. John Logic says. About 1 in 25 adults fall asleep at the wheel each month, according to the CDC, while 6,000 fatal car crashes per year are due to drowsy driving. And a new analysis provides eye-popping insight into how our health can suffer for decades to come. Published online in the journal PLOS Medicine, The study shows that healthy 50-year-olds who sleep 5 hours or less every weeknight have a 30% higher risk of developing two or more chronic health conditions over the next 25 years, compared with peers who sleep 7 hours. By age 70, the risk climbs to 40% in those with the same scanty sleep pattern. The study tracked nearly 8,000 British people from 1985 to 2016, none of whom had multiple chronic diseases to start. A quarter century later, researchers observed far higher risks of diabetes, cancer, coronary artery disease, heart failure, COPD, kidney or liver disease, depression, dementia, Parkinson's disease, and arthritis in those who logged 5 hours of sleep or less. Other recent research has zeroed in on sleep deprivation's effects on specific conditions. A study published online November 2, 2022 by the Science of Diabetes Self-Management and Care suggests that people who report trouble sleeping are likelier to have markers including high cholesterol, greater body weight, and more inflammation that contribute to diabetes. The study involved more than 1,000 Australian adults. There's also a higher risk of obesity among people averaging less than 7 hours of sleep a night, according to a 2018 study in the journal BMJ Open Sport. Hunger hormones are involved, but when we're tired or sleepy, we gravitate more to foods that give us energy, like carbohydrates. Our brains suffer too. A study published in the November 2022 issue of Sleep that tracked more than 26,000 people aged 45 through 85 over 3 years showed those with insomnia faced a greater risk of memory decline and dementia. We know there's a link between sleep and our ability to flush out brain toxins like amyloid proteins associated with Alzheimer's disease. Sleep deprivation may also speed up the process for those destined to develop the disease. Don't despair if you tend to operate on a sleep deficit. It might not be too late to turn around any deprivation-driven health trends, Dr. Clurman says. I want to believe if you start getting more sleep now, your body will begin repairing all the things that happened when you didn't sleep enough, she says. Sleep feels good, so deciding to get more should theoretically be easy. But many of us don't cultivate the environment instead of habits known as sleep hygiene that promote sounder slumber. You should keep a consistent schedule. Go to bed and wake up the same time every day. But if there are nights you haven't slept enough before rising for school or work, it's okay to allow yourself to sleep longer on mornings when that's possible, Dr. Clurman says. You should exercise early in the day. For some, exercising too close to bedtime can keep them up or fuel insomnia. You should ease into sleep. We're good at helping little children do this by reading books and taking warm baths, but it's helpful for adults too, says Dr. John Logic. Light and stimulation are the biggest enemies to getting sleep on time. Put everything aside and read a book in dim light or do something relaxing. Use your bed for only two things. You should associate your bed with sleep and sex, not paying the bills, Dr. Clurman says. Ramp down caffeine use. This stimulant has a half-life of 5 hours in most adults, meaning your body will eliminate about half the caffeine you've consumed in this time, according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. It's wise to avoid it after lunchtime. Skip the nightcap. Alcohol's sedative effects help us to fall asleep quickly, but that effect wears off later in the night, making us more likely to toss and turn. More than one alcoholic drink each day lowers sleep quality by 40%. Put away devices. Blue light from cell phones, tablets, and computers can interfere with our circadian rhythm. the internal body clock that regulates sleep-wake cycles. Blue light filtering glasses can help stem these effects, as can built-in filters available on some devices. Better yet, avoid using electronic devices for an hour or longer before bedtime. Don't use blackout shades in your bedroom, Dr. Clerman says. If you want to stay in sync with the world, you want the morning light to help you wake up. Room darkening shades can be helpful for people with chronic insomnia, however. Avoid using sleep aids for more than a night or two. It's tempting to take sleeping pills, but they carry major risk, especially as we age and are more prone to falls. They should only be used for a specific short-term reason. Taken for longer, sleep aids tend to lose effectiveness within a few weeks and can backfire, disrupting sleep. People with chronic sleep problems can try a form of cognitive behavioral therapy that's geared toward insomnia, which has been shown to work better than drugs, Dr. Clerman says. Also, try tracking your vacation sleep habits. The amount of shut-eye you log when you're not working for a week or two and are unencumbered by normal routines. That's usually how much sleep you actually need, Dr. Jimlogic says. Unfortunately, few people will make it a priority to get that amount during normal times. Now, here's a couple more short articles in the section called Research We're Watching of the Harvard Women's Health Watch, March 2023. And the first article is Shingles is linked with a higher risk for heart disease and stroke. People who've had shingles have a higher long-term risk of developing a major cardiovascular problem. The Harvard-led study, published online November 16, 2022, by the Journal of the American Heart Association, tracked 200,000 American adults, none of whom had ever had a stroke or coronary artery disease, for up to 16 years. Using questionnaires, researchers collected information on shingles, stroke, and heart disease among participants every 2 years, confirming any diagnosis with medical records. Those who had shingles, which is a reactivation of the same virus that causes chickenpox, had a higher risk of stroke or coronary artery disease compared with participants who had not had shingles. The elevated risk for stroke persisted for 12 years or longer after the shingles episode. Much of the study's data was collected before shingles vaccines became widely available. But even after that point, many people eligible for the vaccine do not receive it. They recommended getting vaccinated against shingles to lower the chance of developing not just the painful rash, but also the possible long-term cardiovascular effects. And then finally, there's a brief article entitled National Task Force Updates Recommendations on Hormone Therapy After Menopause. Updated national guidelines on hormone therapy after menopause recommend that women use it only to relieve menopause-related symptoms, not to prevent chronic conditions that become likelier as women's hormone levels drop after menopause. The latest guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force were published in November 2022 in JAMA and recommend against the use of estrogen alone or in combination with progesterone formulations in patches and pills to prevent chronic conditions like osteoporosis or cardiovascular disease. The updated guidelines do not specifically address hormone therapy for menopause-related symptoms, but the authors note that these women and women who went through early menopause due to surgery or other conditions should be considered candidates for hormone treatment. The authors based their recommendations on a review of 24 high-quality studies. While the analysis showed a lower risk of problems like fractures, diabetes, and colorectal cancer among postmenopausal women using hormone therapy, These benefits were outweighed by higher risks of serious conditions, including invasive breast cancer, stroke, and blood clots. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter, and this is the Harvard Health Letter for March 2023. And the first article is called Over-the-Counter Hearing Aids, What We Know So Far. You don't need a prescription for these FDA-regulated hearing aids, but they're not right for everyone. After years of anticipation, FDA-regulated over-the-counter hearing aids are finally showing up online and in stores. About a dozen of the gadgets have made it to market, and more are expected. Here's what we know about over-the-counter hearing aids at this point, and what to keep in mind if you're interested in buying a pair. Unlike the process of getting prescription hearing aids, you don't have to go to a doctor or an audiologist for over-the-counter hearing aids. That means you don't need a formal hearing evaluation, fittings, or a prescription for the devices. You can just buy a pair at your convenience and use them as soon as you open the package. There are two types of over-the-counter hearing aids. Some over-the-counter hearing aids are self-fitting, meaning the device settings can be programmed to suit the user's hearing needs. You'll know it's self-fitting if the product description talks about putting the device in your ear and completing a hearing test, either online, at the manufacturer's website, or on an app, so you can adjust the controls and fine-tune the device. Other over-the-counter hearing aids are not self-fitting. They come with volume control and a few predetermined settings. The new over-the-counter hearing aid category requires manufacturers to register the devices with the FDA and follow specific regulations. For self-fitting devices, manufacturers must demonstrate to the FDA that the hearing aid has been tested and shown to be safe, with volume control and output limits, for example, and effective for adults with mild to moderate hearing loss. Packaging must explain who might benefit from the devices and when it makes sense to see a doctor. These hearing aids can use the word FDA cleared on packing and ads. Non-self-fitting OTC hearing aids must be registered with the FDA, but device makers are not required to demonstrate that the devices are safe. The registration is essentially a claim that the device meets FDA standards. Over-the-counter hearing aids started about $500 to $1,000 per pair. Self-fitting devices are more expensive. Both types cost less than the bundled price of prescription hearing aids, which start at $4,000 per pair and include the services of an audiologist. But $500 is still costly. It's our hope that we'll see more technology emerge and drive down prices. Over-the-counter hearing aids are meant for adults with perceived mild to moderate hearing loss. It's someone who typically does well in a one-on-one conversation, but can't hear well with background noise, at a distance, or in a lecture hall. They need amplification and the ability to tune out unwanted noises. If you have more challenging hearing loss issues, you should see your doctor. Over-the-counter hearing aids have different styles and features, depending on the particular model you buy. For example, some over-the-counter hearing aids look like wireless earbuds. Others look like prescription hearing aids, with a piece that sits behind the ear and a little wire, the speaker that sits in the ear canal. Some over-the-counter devices have directional microphones and noise-canceling features. Some are Bluetooth compatible and can stream to your smartphone. Although it's easier to obtain over-the-counter hearing aids than prescription hearing aids, it's still a sizable investment. You'll want to do research before buying them. Some organizations, like the National Council on Aging, www.health.harvard.edu/NCOA-HEAR, compare device models for consumers. Get a model with the fit, features, and price you want. If you're not sure, you may be able to talk to the seller about it. If it's a drugstore, ask the pharmacist for guidance. If it's an online dealer, there may be a customer service line you can call. You can even make an appointment with a local audiologist to get advice. One important consideration is your ability to operate the hearing aid. Are you good with technology? Would you like to make all the adjustments? Would you prefer having preset functions that can make it easier to operate? Whatever model you're considering, make sure it has two particular features. One is a customer service department, so you can talk to someone if you're having trouble fitting the device, or if they aren't working at some point. The other is a trial period. You need to be able to try them out and return them if they're not right. Remember, we're still in the early stages of over-the-counter hearing aids. We don't know yet which devices will work best and which companies will be around the longest. But if you have the means and you'd like to give the devices a try now, they do have benefits. The next article from the Harvard Health Letter is called Spot the Warning Signs of Four Dangerous Conditions. Don't overlook symptoms of a stroke, heart attack, atrial fibrillation, or a pulmonary embolus. We rarely think life-threatening conditions like a heart attack can happen to us, and we tend to miss signs as such conditions are brewing. You think I'm too young or too healthy for it to be true, and you can ignore important symptoms. Protect yourself by learning the warning signs of the following conditions. And the first one is heart attack. A heart attack occurs when something blocks blood flow to a part of the heart muscle. It can be fatal. The typical symptom is extreme pain or pressure in the middle of the chest. Chest pain that comes and goes, especially with exertion, is one early warning sign. But other symptoms also can be warning signs, like new shortness of breath, fatigue, nausea or vomiting, or sudden pain in the abdomen, back, jaw, or shoulder, even without chest pain. Women are more likely to have these other symptoms in addition to chest pain, but men can also have them, Dr. Lau says. How can you tell it's a heart attack and not something else? Ask yourself two questions. Is the symptom new, and is it recurring or not going away? For example, if you could walk up a flight of stairs yesterday without any issues, and now the same level of activity is very hard for you, something is wrong, Dr. Lau says. Or if you experience a pain in your abdomen, back, jaw, or shoulder when you exert yourself, especially if it recurs or isn't going away, contact your doctor immediately. Next is stroke. A stroke occurs when blood flow to the brain is blocked. It can be fatal. A major stroke can cause sudden difficulty speaking or understanding someone, numbness or weakness on one side of the body, blurry vision, dizziness, or a severe headache. Any one of these warrants an immediate call to 911. In some cases, the first warning of an impending major stroke might be a mini stroke. It has the same symptoms as a major stroke, but it lasts only briefly and is easy to brush off. For example, you might lose vision in one eye for a minute and maybe think it's because you were looking at your smartphone screen too long. But a TIA or mini stroke is often the harbinger of a bigger stroke. The symptom may go away, but the next episode could cause permanent damage. If a stroke symptom of any kind occurs suddenly, even if it goes away, call your doctor's office immediately, Dr. Lau says. Atrial fibrillation. Atrial fib is the name for rapid abnormal contraction of the heart's upper chambers. Instead of squeezing in concert, the atria quiver, which can make the blood inside them pool and form clots. The clots can then travel to the brain, the heart, or other parts of the body and cause life-threatening damage. Many people with AFib don't have any symptoms, but you might detect AFib if you experience palpitations, a feeling that your heart is beating unusually rapidly or irregularly, even when you're resting. You might also feel faint or experience sudden fatigue. And some people recognize it by wearing smartwatches that track heart rhythms. The technology isn't perfect, but it's pretty good at recognizing atrial fib. See your doctor as soon as possible if you have these symptoms. Finally, there's pulmonary embolism. A pulmonary embolism occurs when a blood clot forms in the leg, then travels upward and lodges in the lung. The clot can reduce your body's supply of oxygen-rich blood and damage the lung. Sometimes it's fatal. It can cause blood to back up in the heart and even cause your heart to stop. The main symptom of pulmonary embolism, extreme fatigue and shortness of breath, chest pain, or passing out will probably get your attention. But you might not connect other symptoms to pulmonary embolism. For example, it can cause flu-like symptoms like a cough, fever, dizziness, wheezing, or heart palpitations. If you have blood clots in the deep leg veins, you might have pain, swelling, or redness in one leg. If you're not sure if you have symptoms, think of your risk factors. Have you been sitting for long periods? Are you on a medication that can cause clotting? Do you have a family history of DVT? All these can cause blood clots in the legs. If you have both suspicious symptoms and these risk factors, call your doctor promptly, Dr. Lau says. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.